session number 23198, reel 12.
Mr. Watson, reel 12. Mm. You're just telling us about the problem with coning of searchlights and predicted fire on some of the raids. If you'd carry on with that.
Well, they would then hand you over to another bunch of searchlights, so that between them they knew your exact direction of flying, and by simple geometry from the various things, they would establish accurately your height. So they would hand you over knowing your height and your track. Now this they could feed into their little computer thing and predict when you were going to be at a certain point at a certain time. Thus, very simply, they could then send a bunch of anti-aircraft fire right onto your track.
Now, one other thing that I noticed is window. You mentioned window in here. Yeah. Can you just briefly explain what window was?
Window was a form of radar deflection. It was consists of strips of paper, about half the width of that.
About half an inch or three quarters of an inch.
Something like that. And they were doubled, and about that length.
About 12 inches.
Yeah, about that. And they were bundled together. Now, they could be either held in the bomb bay, or they could be chucked out down the flare chute. The flare chute was where they fought a flare in the middle of the aircraft. It stood up about this height, and it was a square chute, and you dropped things through it. It also housed the photographic apparatus. Now, we usually carried them in the bomb bay, in addition to the bombs. And they came out, they were held in clamps in what were normally the incendiary. Incendiaries were held in clamps. An incendiary was something like that, square, longer, and held in sort of brackets, and they were clamped into the bomb bay, which normally carried the bombs. When they were when they dropped out, they dispersed, and the window, that's the code name for it, also dropped out, and it fluttered as a cloud of strips, metallized strips, and they formed a blip on the ground radar, so that if you dropped them, they hung in the air for quite a time, and by that time you were farther away. So, of course, the anti-aircraft fire was directed at these strips.
Now, the next thing was on the 23rd of October, you had a night raid on Essen, and this is where I think the incident that you most remember would be when the bomb got trapped. Can you tell me exactly, you know, as much as you remember about that? Because that does seem to be an interesting incident.
It was. Bloody dangerous one, too. Well, I won't go into the bombing bit. We bombed this, but discovered that one 2,000-pound bomb was hung up. In other words, it hadn't been released. And this could happen because the grease and the release mechanism had frozen hard, and it had stuck up. Not an unusual occurrence. However, once it was stuck up, opened the bomb doors again and tried to throw it off by diving the aircraft, pulling back very hard on the stick, and tried to throw it off by centrifugal force, which was unsuccessful. However, we carried on and we started descending a little, and as we descended, of course, the bloody bomb dropped off, and there was a loud thump, and the aircraft rocked, and the bomb was lying in, held up by the bomb doors, which of course were hydraulic operated, so it's in there. Now, that bomb had a nose fuse. In other words, there's a rod in front, which when hit the ground, detonated. Now, in the front, if you understand the bomb bay, under the bomb aimer, to get down into his position, went down about 18 inches into the front of the aircraft, and in the bulkhead behind him, he lay down here to look through in his bomb sight. Behind him was the bomb bay, and there's a bulkhead about that height, and there's a porthole in it. And this loud bump meant that the bomb had come off and was lying in the bomb bay. Now, we had received strong instructions that we were not to drop anything over France, discharge anything, because some people had been indiscriminately dropping these hang-ups over France and killing people and killing animals because they were being dropped anywhere that they could get rid of them. So we had been told that we must take our bombs back and go out to the wash and drop them out in the sandbanks there. So, as we didn't want to kill any French, so the farm animals were apparently being mown down by our own aircraft, we would head back and go out and drop it there. Well, the bomb aimer, Stan, always carried a torch, and in the bulkhead was a little porthole, so he could look back into the bomb bay. And he shone his little torch in there, and he saw the bomb lying facing him, and it was primed, because it became primed as soon as it left the bomb rack, because it was connected. And not only that, it was very slowly approaching him as he looked through. And of course the consequences of it hitting the bulkhead be rather disastrous for all of us. So he yelled suddenly, "It's sliding down, pull up a bit." So Ken pulls up. "Not too fast, that's plenty." And the bomb stopped running. And then, lo and behold, it started going back. "It's sliding back. He's forward. It's coming down." And this is what went on all across bloody France. And so now we want to drop in the sea first time. Now, who's going to see the sea first? Likely me, because I could look down. I said, so we're coming and I'm looking everywhere. And by this time we'd come down to about 6,000 or 7,000 feet. I could see the ground roughly through there. And I could see the line of surf as we came over the English Channel coast. I said, "I can see the surf below me. Right, give it a couple of minutes," and then, well, we were crossing near Calais in the Channel, southwest of Calais. So, right, bomb doors open, go over the bank. I watch it. Bloody great splash. And then the bloody heavens opened. We dropped in the middle of the bloody Channel fleet. And of course they thought it was the bloody Germans. And my God, the aeroplane just about went. Anyway, we called up on Darkie for emergency. And they put us into, I think it was Manston or somewhere. Was it Great Ashfield or something? I can't remember.
Quite sure.
But Manston was a relief landing ground where anything that was crippled went to Manston, because it had a very long runway and was the nearest point to the continent that was fit to take an aircraft. But the Navy were most displeased and they gave us a very rough time.
Now, and the next thing is a raid on Cologne in daylight. Now, the reason you'd remember that is it was your birthday. Could you tell us about that?
Yes, well...
It's the 28th of October, 1944.
Yeah. Isn't that a power station?
I can't see what it says. Synthetic benzene and power station.
That's it.
Yeah, there's a power station in there.
It was called the... something sack.
Knapsack
power station. Yes, we went there and we were only at 9,000 feet, could see everything in the ground, and there's two bloody great chimneys, I remember. This was a power station. And we went, you know, right between the power, not between them, but between them in distance, but up a bit. Not very far up above it, but about maybe 6,000-7,000 feet or something. Very lovely day, clear sea, everything. And we just dropped it there between the power station chimneys. So that finished a lot of the power for Cologne or somewhere. That was that one.
No, you were telling me about the birthday thing.
That was on the...
It's on the way back, I think.
On the way back. Happy birthday to you, and accompanied to the bangs of the anti-aircraft fire. That's about all.
Okay. We've just noticed that the next flight in here is the flight, the attack on Mulberry, I think it is. Or Bockham, rather, 4th of November. And that's where Mulberry was shot down, and the business about the adjustment.
Oh, right.
Committee of Adjustment crew. So you moved to Fiskerton in November. Now, one story you want to tell, which we haven't quite got the raid for yet, perhaps I'll spot it, was this one where you almost landed on top of another Lancaster.
Oh,
can you tell that story? What happened there?
well, we rejoined the circuit to land, of course, along with others returning. And we'd been warned that there were intruders, night fighters from Germany, intruding into various aerodromes, trying to shoot down the returning bombers, which was a soft touch, really, for them, because all they had to do was...
Can you explain that, yeah?
Yes, right. And we were turning into the final approach and just about to land when the whole radio lights went out, the airfield lights went out. And, of course, we were committed to landing. We were, you know, just a few hundred feet. And at that point, as the lights went off, an aircraft was tacking on to taxi off onto the runway to take off. Of course, when all the runway lights went off, he stayed where he was, sitting on the end of the blooming runway. And of course, we were committed to landing. He hadn't moved. So we careered in tandem down the bloody runway on top of him.
Too much damage?
Damaged the airplanes. Damaged his main spar. And I remember our nose ended up on his port wing. See, like you know, on the left side of the end. And his port propellers took the guns out of the front turret of our aircraft and tossed them, wrecking the turret. Good job there was nobody in it, in the front turret, but nobody in it for landing at all. It's normally the bomber was in there. And our nose ended up on his port wing, between the engines.
And that was at Fiskerton?
Yeah, and we careered across the, I think I told you about the airfield, and ended up opposite the...
What did you think of the American Air Force and the Flying Fortress? Because you mentioned this while we were before. Can you just comment on that a little?
Well, the Flying Fortress was synonymous, I would think, with the American philosophy. Hit them and hit them hard. But defense was the primary objective. It's called a fortress. And a fortress is a defensive place. So their philosophy was, as you build an airplane, make it a fortress, flying fortress, full of armor plating and various other protectors, and all the crew wear armor vests and all this stuff. Armor plating in the turrets, armor plating under the pilot's backside and at his back and behind his head and all the rest of it. And the result is, of course, that they can't take anything like the bomb load that the Lancaster can take, where the only bit of armor plating is a bit behind the pilot's head. See, the more you take of that protective stuff, and the more expensive the engines are, and they had engines that galloped up the fuel, whereas our engines were far more economical because we didn't have the fuel. America was on a continent stuffed with fuel, so they designed their airplanes accordingly. So they gulped up the fuel, and of course, because they carried all this fuel and armor plating, they couldn't take the bombs.
Did you take the Mickey out of American pilots when you met them?
Oh, the ground crews did. Oh,
what would they say?
They sang the old song.
Which was?
Flying silver fortresses at 50,000 feet. We are flying silver fortresses at 50,000 feet. Flying silver fortresses at 50,000 feet. But we've only got the teeny weeny bomb. Bong, bong, bong. We didn't sing it, but the ground crews did.
That's very good. Now, any other thing? You've got attacks on Koblenz and then Bonn. I don't know whether you remember the Christmas Day raid. You made a night raid on Christmas, around Christmas.
Where to?
On Koblenz. So not Christmas Day, 22nd
December. I don't remember a Christmas Day.
No. And then Bonn on the 28th and 7th.
I told you all about the Christmas trees, didn't I?
No.
Didn't I? Oh, dear.
What was that about?
When they were diverted to Charter Hall. Is something...
There's a little slip in there, but I don't remember, no.
I'm sure I marked it.
You've marked it, yes, but you haven't told us the story, yes.
Oh, I see.
This was on the raid on the 22nd of December, 44, on Koblenz.
Koblenz, yes, that's it.
What happened then?
Bloody long trip, of course. Koblenz is a damn long way from England. Well, we came back after having done a bit here at Koblenz, and we couldn't land at our base, and we were diverted to Charter Hall. Charter Hall is up near Berwick in the borderland. It's surrounded by plantations, thousands of acres of plantations of conifers of various kinds. That is relevant, actually. And when we got there, there were a lot of other Lancasters milling around. We couldn't find the place, but what happened, they had called a chance light, which is a vertical light shining upright from the middle of the station. But that didn't tell you anything about the runway, which direction it was on. You got that, but you didn't know, other than that this chance light was from the station. Now, we were above cloud, and the only thing we could see was the glow of the chance light shining through the clouds, which I suppose covered hundreds of yards. Anyway, there's all these Lancasters there, assembling, milling around, damn near colliding with one another. It was damn sight more dangerous than the operation. And there was a controller down below trying to stack us up. And if you imagine somebody's flying at 15,000 feet coming in there, and he said, right, your stack height is 18,000, and you're trying to climb through another gaggle of aircraft to get to that height, you can imagine the confusion. Anyway, we were very short of fuel. We had a whole tank and been spilling fuel all the way back, cloud of fumes streaming out behind us. And the we were anxious to get down. Called up, by this time we were short of fuel, and the pilot called up, gave the call sign, "Dog 2, short of fuel, priority landing." Back came a bloody reply from another aircraft, "We're all bloody short of fuel." Anyway, got down, and this airfield was operating bullfighters. That's twin-engine night fighters. And they were trying to land their bullfighters in between our Lancasters, so there was a bit of chaos in the control tower. However, we got down, taxied off, and because there was no room in the dispersals, we were parked nose to tail all around the taxiways, because there must have been about 20 Lancasters all diverted to that point. So we adjourned to get a debriefing in the ops room. It was because the Beauvoir station, everything was on a smaller scale from a bomber command station, but we got the usual hospitality, went to the dining hall. And one thing I remember about that is the way the girls there sort of went out of their way to sort of service and do everything, you know, you could to make you welcome. And we stayed there, and next day, of course, we had to get fuel. There was about a dozen Lancaster parked all round, and we had to go back to our bases. So they gave us enough fuel merely to take us back, because they couldn't afford to give us any more from the stocks. And because it was a small, comparatively small station compared with a bomber station, the transport was very stretched. And in order to take crews back to the aircraft, once they'd got enough fuel and it was daylight and the weather was better at our base, we were going back to base, and they sent to collect us, to ground the messes, a Queen Mary. Now, I don't know if you know what a Queen Mary is, but it's a long, low loader with two wheels. And this base charter hall, they were very close to all the forestry in the area, and they had, behind the sergeants and officer messes, piles of points of conifer trees which had been chopped off and stored for Christmas around the stations. So, being based in the East Anglia, where there wasn't a tree in sight, just blooming beet fields and so, Christmas trees were at a premium, because they weren't transportable, I suppose, on the railways, and there were few and far between. So, outside the sergeant's mess was piles of these trees, which had been chipped off with the axe points. The vegetation grew up. I'll show you one out in the front there. The branches grew up, and then the sharp point. Yeah. So, as we're passing, standing in this Queen Mary, where the sides of it were, it was about from there to there wide, two wheels, and about 20 feet long, used for carrying planes, wings and things. And we're standing all on this. As we come to the sergeant's mess to pick up some of the other crews, NCOs, there's a lot of these Christmas trees in the coal bunker place outside. So, seeing the opportunity, we dive over the side, load up half a dozen of these, jump back in, and in the meantime, the driver has been engaged in conversation and offered a fag at the door, and another chap standing so that his mirror, his view, you know, the window in the back of the cab of the Remy, so he's standing his back to that to block any of the driver's view. We'd all been told about all these tricks from the escape exercises, so we're well up to these sort of things. We loaded some in there, stood on them, and off we went down to dispersals. Now we went through the same routine down at the dispersal to delay the driver. Somebody offered him a fag in through the cab. Somebody else stood so that his driving mirror was through the window at the back of the cab was obscured. And otherwise, we unloaded quietly the Christmas trees. When he had gone, the engineer went into the aircraft, pumped down the bomb doors, could do it by hand, opened the bomb doors. We held the trees up into the bomb bay, and he pumped the bomb doors closed. Mind you, a few bits of vegetation sticking out where the bomb doors. So, job done. Taxi out, get airborne, and then on comes the voice of authority, the wing commander of that station. The aircraft, so and so and so and so, you have to return and land immediately. And of course, he didn't say why, because he wanted us to think it was our base getting on to us, that something had happened that we must stay there. Obstructed runway or something. And however, we guessed that his intentions weren't quite what he was meaning. Anyway,
so you carried on.
We carried on. And next thing, there's two bullfighters because they operated formating on either side of it. And they were going like a
shaking up this side.
And we were going
making V signs.
and he was making gestures, you know, he was going to shoot us down. I turned the turret around on him, and the elevator guns went brrrr, and he buggered off. I thought, two can play that game, man. But I wouldn't have liked to battle with a bullfighter because he had a hefty punch. But anyway, this beat us back to our base, and when we got back, there was two of us, you see, we came back and from two of us together, and we went low level, got the bomb doors open, just as we're going past the front of the flying wing. In front of the flying was the Met Observer Square. Have you seen these? Where they have their barometers and temperature gauges. And there's a Met man out there taking his, Met observer, taking his readings, temperature and wet bulb and all the rest of it. And he was there minding his own business, writing up his little notes. And we came across, low level, bomb doors open, and all these trees came out. And of course they were so shaped that I'll show you the type of tree. The branches grew up, and they made a perfect feathers for darts. And they went, chink, chink, chink. And this, you can see that little lad here running like hell. And the wing commander wasn't very pleased at all. But anyway, the rest of the camp were, because they had Christmas trees. I mean, you couldn't get them for love or money, but we were down in Lincolnshire. Wasn't a tree in sight for miles.
And there was no comeback from that?
Oh, there was. They rang up and complained. The wing commander there complained bitterly because we had pinched trees. And, of course, we'd briefed it. We expected it, you see. And, there's plenty of bloody trees up there that can go out and get trees any time. And I think that's what he told them. But I don't know. He didn't bother us anyway.